Thank you actually for having me here. So I'm Sudhakar Mantra. I'm a lecturer with the UCB Center for Humanitarian Action. Today we have, as you can see, a very, very interesting and, dare I say, provocative topic, because it says Islam or democracy. It's not even Islam and democracy, which would have been provocative enough. But even the assumption in the title, I think, is very, very interesting. And I think we have even more provocative speakers. We have here with us Sheikh Abdullah Al-Andalusi and Martin Okolik. I'm sorry for my pronunciation. Abdullah is the founding member of the Muslim Debate Initiative, and if you've had the time to visit his blog and his website, you'll see that he's quite prolific in his writing as well as in his debates. And he's a debater on Islam, theology, politics, and Muslim affairs. And then Martin is a doctoral researcher in SPIRE, which is the School of Politics and International Relations. And you're also the an occasional lecturer, and your interest, the primary research interests, are in the field of political methodology, comparative politics, with a particular focus on elections, voting behavior, quality of government, spatial econometric models, and time series analysis. So very, very interesting indeed. So please, if you could welcome our speakers today. So we have, I'm sure all of you will have quite a few questions towards the end of it. So let me invite Martin first to just introduce the topic and present in broad terms the relation between democracy and Islam and its links to global peace. And then we'll invite Abdullah to speak or to present a critique of the secular liberal democracy and present his thoughts on the relation between Islam and democracy. And then at the end, we'll leave considerable time for your questions and observations, okay? So thank you very much, and over to Martin.
A question to the audience first. Would you like us to stand or would you like us to sit? Is it visible if we sit or? Yeah, that's fine, okay. Then the second, I would like to thank. Thank you, Selagna. And I would like to thank also Islamic Society and Philosophy Society for inviting us on this talk. I think it's an interesting topic, but it's a topic, and I will start with that, it's a concept which is quite different from each other. So if you look at the pure explanation of democracy and Islam, you're going to hit the first difference. The first one is political system, the second one is religion. If we look at both democracy and Islam, we can also have a secondary opinion about these two concepts. And that kind of secondary opinion might bring those two together in terms of culture. So we might look at democracy as a cultural, as a traditional approach toward how some people live their life. We can look at Islam toward a cultural approach, toward a traditional approach, toward the way of how you would live life. And if we put that kind of cultural perspective in this very different concept, say it's religion versus political system, what that has to do with each other, then we are going to start to see the first critics of whether those two concepts are mutual, or that whether they can stand together. So the first critic, it's not just about Islam as a religion. It will be in the literature, Confucianism also as a religion, or other types of religions that are not suitable for democracy as a political system. So many scholars will argue that some religions are not prone toward democratization, and therefore we would not expect democratization in those countries that follow that kind of religious background. Why would that be an issue? Why would a culture be an issue? Well, some would argue that Some religions would provide some kind of hierarchical structure in the society, and that hierarchical structure in the society, it's what's against that kind of inclusiveness of what democratic system would would prefer. So instead of having an opinion of everyone, an argument, in Confucianism, for example, you will have that an individual characteristic, so the individual opinion is better preferred compared to an argument that can bring us to a conflict. So in that kind of sense, scholars will argue that some religious backgrounds are not going to be prone toward democratization. In terms of Islam, that would be that political participation, usually in the literature, it's linked very closely to the religious affiliation. So it's the God, then it's those who would speak the words of God, and they are the ones, and they have to be always included in the policy or in the politics of the country. And that kind of secular definition of democratization, if you will, would be the one that is very well written in the society. We can look at another cultural approach, which would be that Sharia law should be the law that is implemented in the society, and etc., etc. But behind all this culturalist perspective, or whether we are suited for a particular political system, there are examples that will refute us. Because if you asked in the 60s or in the 50s, many scholars will tell you that Catholicism is not prone toward democratization, and that if you have Catholicism in a particular country, you are less likely to have democracy. Why was that? But that was because of the Catholicism, the Pope, and how the hierarchical structure in the religion in Catholicism was maintained. Everything changed in the 60s. So many scholars before that would argue that having authoritarian regimes and having less of a democratic countries in countries that have Catholicism as a religion was because of that kind of hierarchical structure. We evolve as humans, we evolve as society, we evolve as culture. Therefore, if you look at from today's perspective, the Catholicism as a kind of a problem toward democratization would be insignificant. Most of the countries today would be that are Catholic would be also democratic. The same stands for Islamic countries. So we have Turkey with a long period of democratization. We probably have Lebanon. So Lebanon might be reaching soon, if not already, the minimalistic definition of democracy in terms of electoral democracy. We see changes in Iraq. So some scholars will argue that soon enough, maybe in the next decade, in Iraq we are going to have at least established electoral democracies. This can go in both ways. And don't get it wrong, that has been happening everywhere in the world. So Catholic countries went back to authoritarianism. So we have Venezuela, we have Bolivia, we have many cases where this kind of process toward democratization was going in both ways. So it can be a reverse, or it can be going toward democratization. Another issue that was brought in the literature was that in order to become democracy, or in order to connect to the democratic values, first you need to have a high level of economic gain, which is a case in especially Arab region, or especially the Arab countries, where the level of GDP per capita is very high. So the standard of people who are living there is very high. So scholars now start thinking, okay, so there is something else that is protecting those countries of becoming democracies. And they found that, okay, maybe it's rentier states. So if we are not paying taxes, we should not demand liberties. If we are paying taxes, then we better demand freedoms from the government. We can sustain not having that kind of freedoms as long as our life is provided in any kind of sense from the countries. But the truth is that even if you ask, and that's the latest survey, so that's what people from the Arab world are telling us, would be if you run surveys there, you would see that majority of the people would agree or would support democratization. They would support democracy. There will be a little bit of disagreement about defining the concept of democracy, but most of the people from any kind of background in the world, if you ask them a question about support for democracy, do you support democracy or not, high percent will say yes, that they do support democracy. The disagreement comes in a sense where we should probably do a little bit of our research into how do you look at democracy. So that's another concept. And that's why I started with a little bit dividing this, whether we look at Islam as a religion or whether we look at Islam as a way of life, whether we look at democracy as a political system. If it is just a political system, then it's all a matter of election and it's nothing more than that. Or whether we look at democracy as a way of life, way of living. Once we start interpreting concepts, I think that's what will bring us to the answer of this question. Then we reach problems. So if you look at democracy, there is one fact that no democratic countries has ever fought another democratic countries. So this is known as non-aggression hypothesis. So no democracies have ever been in war between each other. However, they have bullied many other countries or many other systems. So if you see it in that way, it is some kind of teenager that is bullying the others, but not the group that they belong to. Islam as a religion does not preaches any kind of violence. No single religion would promote any kind of violence. So if we are looking from the concept, from our beginning of, from our starting point, both democracy and Islam are very good for global peace, because they will both promote, in their main sense, global peace. I think that the problem becomes once we try interpreting those concepts, and then maybe the truth behind this whole question would be that we are those that are not compatible with living in peace or making a global peace, but it's more of our interpretation that needs to be changed compared to these two concepts. So I would argue that first, Islam, as any other religion, can implement democratic political system, because democratic political system in its core means just having elections and deciding for who you want to vote or to. And at the end of the day, democracy does not mean prosperity. We have been very clear about that, especially in the last 10 years. So democracy is just another political system. Islam is a religion, as any other religion, with their own beliefs. Those two concepts are not going to be in clash as long as we start interpreting them usually wrongly or subjectively. So that will be my introduction here. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, the most gracious, most merciful, I'd like to wish you all a good evening. And I'd also like to thank the UCD Islamic Society and the UCD Philosophical Society for arranging this debate, and thanking you all here for attending today to listen to this. Now, I'd like to start off with a few disclaimers first. I know this is a debate, and I'd like to reassure everyone that despite my background, I'm not here to argue that Ireland becomes a theocracy, where the head of state is also the head of religion. I know the Irish wouldn't accept that, so I promise to you that I will not try to return the Queen of England back into power here. Nor, as a Muslim, do I want to transform your Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, into a Taoiseach. So you don't have to worry about that either. I'm here today to discuss the effectiveness of secular liberal democracy, or known euphemistically as democracy, by many of its advocates. It is currently the most prominently advocated form of government in the world today. Its prominence grew due to, I would argue, Western colonialism and the redesigning of former colonies and countries under its spheres of influence into its own image. True believers in secular democracy may invoke it as dogmatically as a panacea, or at least as a starting point to solving mankind's political and social problems, or at least positing as the best solution, or the best of the worst, as Winston Churchill famously said. And democracy is also viewed as a solution to create political stability in regimes or peace, according to Immanuel Kant's democratic peace theory. Of course, political theorists and philosophers like Marcus with a colleague, also know better, know that some of these common narratives are not necessarily reflective of the truth. Also, in popular discourse, alternatives to secular liberal democracy are caricatured as nightmarish dystopic realms, which, if not secular liberal democracies, must be either tyrannical autocracies or totalitarian oppressive ideologies or theocracies. Of course, this simply isn't true. If we depart from the Western-centric view, the history of the world, including modern day, is witness to many alternative and mixed systems and perhaps the possibility of better ones. Now, my colleague was correct. Islam isn't in total just a ruling system. It is a comprehensive worldview and way of life based upon a belief in one creator which created mankind and the universe and upon which all human purpose is centered. However, because Islam is comprehensive, it gives guidance as to the kinds of ruling systems that best organizes mankind's political activities according to its own basis. Contrary to what, unfortunately, some Islamophobes, hate mongers, and fanatical militant secularists might have you believe, Islam does not advocate totalitarianism, autocracy, fascism, or the current definition of theocracy. In fact, it actually is against those systems, quite diametrically opposed to those systems in any interpretation that you might raise. Islam advocates a system with some kind of selection of the leader. Elections has also been a historical precedent. It has elected rulers and accountability of government. Islam believes in all those things. Islam believes that the government should limit its scope to the public realm, and the government does not have political jurisdiction over your private lives inside your homes. Someone should tell this to the NSA and GCHQ in UK. However, this might raise in you the idea that, well, doesn't this sound then very similar to secular liberal democracies then? Well, maybe only in terms of structure, but maybe not in terms of the content of the particular laws. However, this is where the similarities end. And it is the differences today that I will focus on in pursuit of answering the question, which system is better to achieve a global peace? Now, I've dealt with a brief summary of what Islam is, and before we delve into Islam in more detail, I think we should look a bit more at what we think we know is democracy. Again, none of this is going to be a mystery to anyone who studies political philosophy, but it's for those who maybe haven't. Democracy originally meant rule of the people, and by that I mean direct rule of the people. The modern system of elections in the West is not democracy as defined by the Athenians who originated the system. Democracy is about 2,500 years old. A democracy is 1,000 years older than Islam, so technically Islam is more modern than democracy. However, in ancient Athens, all eligible citizens could vote on any law, any policy, and a certain, say, senior class could vote on court cases. All eligible citizens, and I say eligible citizens, obviously not women or slaves, but Athens called itself a democracy, and that's how they understood democracy. There was no fixed leaders. People, in essence, you had demagogues, which we call politicians today, who would be considered to be, quote-unquote, first amongst equals, possibly, if they were really influential, but there was no fixed leaders. In fact, most of the founding fathers of the newly emerging political systems in the West, Burke, Jefferson, Madison, were actually completely against democracy. They were concerned about the rule of the mob, the possibility of the sacrifice of minorities. Instead, they picked a system called republicanism, which Rome practiced, where you elect representatives who, according to Edmund Burke, were there to think for you and would implement policy on your behalf because you wouldn't be able to obviously think about the political issues. Sometimes a republicanism is called a mixed constitution as well, with a mixture of, as Edmund Burke described it, a touch of democracy, a bit of aristocracy, and a bit of monarchy, as describes the UK system. Now, in the 19th century, something happened. Republicanism was generally kind of relabeled democracy, and its meaning was changed to reflect the intention of the system, maybe to placate the masses, who knows, rather than a description of the structural system. So democracy was previously a description of the structural system where the people actually themselves directly rule. And instead it came to be changed to mean the intention behind the system is that, oh, the people are intended to rule, but they can't rule themselves, so we'll fool them, those who are elected. And most of the Western countries have actually built their systems being very concerned about the rule of the mob, and actually having many systems in place to prevent that occurrence from occurring. So in Western countries, including Ireland, for example, the Senate, or the upper house, is meant to act as a counterweight and fail-safe to the elected representatives who are in the lower house. While the lower house is elected by the people, the upper house are generally not elected by the people directly, with the possible exception of USA, that they have referendums on senators. And in many cases, the Senate are elected by either privileged individuals, those who are viewed as captains of industry. Apparently the Irish senators, some of them are selected by members of the Irish universities as well. In the UK, you have the clergy who are basically, there's a fixed allotment of clergy who are clerics in the upper house, the House of Lords. Now, of course, there's constitutions and there's also the judiciary, which again are not directly elected by the people. And all this was designed to prevent rule of the mob, to prevent majority rule, because we didn't know what majority rule would bring if people directly started to decide the rules for themselves. Anyone that studied the history of Athens will know just kind of what chaos and injustice occurred when mob rule was enacted. Now, this seems well and fine, but there is one means of control of the lower house, of people who are directly elected. And that was that people who are elected are in need of being promoted. Most of you won't know of many independents if they don't have much money or money backing them. But those who do have money backing them, you will hear about them because they can afford advertising campaigns and they can afford influence with media. And this influences how you vote and gives some means of control as to the outcomes of elections. And I think just recently there was an email leak by Hillary Clinton where she was talking about the need that they should have controlled the outcome of the Palestinian elections in Gaza, for example. How can you control the outcome of an election if it's purely the will of the people and you can't control it? Well, you can, because you can, with advertising campaigns, with media and so on and so forth in your pocket, you can achieve a lot. And that's why the mainstream parties will generally get elected consistently, because they have a lot of resources and a lot of financial backers. Unfortunately, it's not one person, one vote, but maybe $1, one vote, or €1, one vote. And that seems to be the case. Rupert Murdoch has more influence on the results of elections than most of you. And that's just a reality of democracy. And it's not only in the West, but also in other countries. So, according to the Athenians, there is no democracy today, maybe possibly Switzerland to some extent, but not in the rigorous way that the Athenians would have wanted. So really then, there isn't any real democracies today. What we have are just republic systems or mixed constitutions with unelected heads of state like the UK, which we call democracy because it sounds like rule of the people. However, this doesn't mean now that the debate ends, because there's no countries to compare it to. I said secular liberal democracy because I think that what I was trying to pick on was the system itself, secular liberalism when applied in a validity or a system. Now, as anyone who studied history knows, that the more democracies you have in the world does not necessarily mean the more peace you have in the world. And of course, democracies have been quite violent ever since the Athenian invasion of or attack on Syracuse, as well as the fight with Carthaginia and so on, so Rome versus Carthaginia, as well as today. Even I think there are recent examples. There's Russia versus Ukraine. I know you can debate, is Russia real democracy, is Ukraine real democracy, but ostensibly they're meant to be democracies. Of Russia versus Georgia, which was a recent wars between democracies, liberal democracies, depending on how you define that, of course, and that's the problem. And why is that? How comes the Athenians were very aggressive and the Romans before they became an empire, which is a different discussion as to why that came about. Why were they actually very aggressive during their supposed Republican period and after during their Democratic period? And how is it that the USA has, I think, it has been at war with a lot of peoples every year since its creation, bar one, possibly. I think I have to go and check that. But it's virtually been at war every year of its existence. How can this be? Well, in democracy, I would argue that Immanuel Kant's theory is actually possibly flawed. Because if a autocrat or an unelected oligarchy initiates wars that fail, the people will blame them for those wars. But in a democracy, if a demagogue or a politician manages to persuade the people to vote for a war, to a parliament or a senate to vote for a war, or they persuade public opinion to go for a war, then when the war turns out badly, well, no individual really gets the real blame. No one will be struck in front of a court. Blame Tony Blair and George Bush have got away virtually scot-free. And what do they say in their defense? It's not us that should be to blame, but rather we were just enacting the normal processes of democracy. So you can't even single them out anymore. And that means that there's less accountability for demagogues who influence the masses of the people. What about economic prosperity? Of course, as my colleague also affirmed, it's viewed as a myth now that democracy must equal economic prosperity. Anyone that just looks at China, I suppose, is an obvious example. But there are many studies that have said the same. Adam, if I'm pronouncing his surname pretty, Przeworski, and Fernando Limongi said in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, we do not know whether democracy fosters or hinders economic growth, based on their studies. So democracy doesn't necessarily lead to economic prosperity either. As for democracy in action, well, in the Middle East today, we see that Iraq is meant to be, in a sense, to be a democracy. It suffered from immense partisanship. Kenya suffered from violent partisanship. We see Thailand, we see Burma. And in fact, the countries in the Middle East which are autocracies, except with the exception of Saudi Arabia, most of them actually started out as democracies. That's why the head of state is called a president. But they managed to be subverted by a popular demagogue who came to power and didn't want to leave, and suddenly started to get 99% election results every election subsequent to that. Much like the Roman Republic became the Roman Empire, the problem with democracies is the inability to prevent popular demagogues from getting to power. I was tempted to ask the organizers to delay this debate a few weeks until after the US presidential election to add a possible other example, but These are issues. According to studies compiled by Germany's Bertelsmann Foundation, they've noticed a gradual qualitative erosion, quote-unquote, of democracy globally, and they've concluded that a number of democracies today are, quote-unquote, highly defective democracies, and they are so flawed that they're close to being failed states, autocracies, or both, and that the number of these has doubled since from 2006 to 2010, those who are classified as highly defective democracies. We see, obviously, examples from Russia, Venezuela, Thailand, Philippines, again, mentioned by my colleague, these things are not unknown. And, of course, we see Larry Diamond, co-editor of the journal Democracy, very famous, obviously, academic on democracy, also cited by my colleague in his work. He said it's no longer plausible. It no longer seems plausible to regard this condition as simply as a temporary stage in the process of democratic transition. So we see that the rise of defective democracies, democracies that are failing or declining, this gradual erosion is no longer now viewed as a temporary phenomenon. It might even be viewed as a direction of travel. It's also been, he also described this as a democratic recession that we're going through. So I'm saying that democracies don't really guarantee stability. In many cases, they create partisanship, where you take a country that has multiple ethnic groups, inject them with nationalism, and then make them fight it out in elections. They might not like the results of those elections, because the majority party, or the party that gets 51% of the vote, that their sect or ethnic group will begin oppressing the minority ethnic group. One famous example of this is Iraq, and we all know how that's turning out today, unfortunately. Now, in contrast, in Islam, and I'll kind of just finish on a brief discussion about then what alternative system am am I positing here? In Islam, I actually prevent people who ask for power from getting power. So in Islam, a person cannot self-promote himself to be a candidate. The constitution of an Islamic government really includes the totality of the Sharia. So all of Sharia or Islamic law is in essence one big constitution. Of course, in an Islamic government, no one has a monopoly on interpreting the Sharia. So there's a plurality of different jurisprudent opinions, and the caliph, or the person who has been selected by the Muslims to implement the Islamic law, can select which interpretation he wants depending on what is the strongest opinion, what's been debated and discussed into power. And that is no different to Western democracies, which, of course, you might have a Republican interpretation or a conservative interpretation of secular liberalism, or you might have a liberal interpretation of secular liberalism, or you might have neoconservative, or you might have ultra-nationalist, you might have all kinds of different schools of thought, depending on who's in government and who interprets secular liberalism as an ideology. Of course, secular liberalism as an ideology has more difference of opinion amongst itself than Islam does between the Muslim different schools of thought. In fact, there's a famous joke amongst academics, which is that liberals cannot agree in anything in liberalism except the name liberalism. Right? Whereas in Islam, there is surprisingly large, or maybe not surprisingly large, a degree of agreement on the very basic ideas, principles, and structures of state amongst the Muslims, even amongst the biggest sects and schools of thought. Most of the differences are actually more in minor points of theology, but in essence, Muslims generally agree on all the basic structures of state. Now, unlike Western systems, Islam obliges, as a legal obligation, the Islamic government to consult people on their needs and requirements. It's called shura in Arabic. And that shura is basically a government which consults the people on what it needs, and then, based on their decision, will then provide what they have said they need. Whereas, for example, referendums, at least outside of Switzerland and some parts of the United States, are not legally binding on government. So the recent Brexit vote in the UK is not actually legally binding on the UK government to enact that vote. Of course, because they don't trust the mob rule. But there's obviously discussion, there's difference of opinion with regards to why the UK government is pursuing a Brexit. But generally, referendums are not legally binding on the government unless they want it to be binding. The Islamic political system, as I said, allows people to elect a caliph, because in Islam, the obligation of implementing the laws of Islam upon Muslims is a collective obligation that all Muslims share. So Muslims will start out with the authority to select leaders. And then by selecting leader, by some process which best suits the social structure of that society, whether it's electoral colleges or tribal chiefs or others, or whether it's direct elections where people put on electronic booths and they make a selection, whatever process is used, after that process is concluded and a person has been selected, Muslims transfer authority by the process called bay'ah in Arabic, which means the pledge of allegiance, which transfers authority from the Muslim public to a leader who will then have authority on condition that he implements the Islamic law, which was the condition of the bay'ah agreement in the first place. And it's called the akd al-hakamiyyah, the contract of ruling between the people and the leader. And this is not a modern understanding of Islam. This is a 1400-year understanding of Islam. We see that if a caliph commits injustice or becomes incompetent, the Supreme Court can impeach the caliph and remove the caliph from office. I counted at least 10 or 11 Ottoman sultans or Ottoman caliphs which were impeached by what's called the Sheikh of Islam, which you might consider to be the supreme judge. Removed the caliph for either the caliph became mad, the caliph became tyrannical, and was removed by a fatwa from the highest judge. And of course, a caliph is elected to implement the laws of Islam, which will provide and guarantee people's rights. So then, if the caliph has a tenor, or traditionally in Islam has always had a tenor, which is as long as they are basically fulfilling the needs of the people and they are competent, as soon as they cease becoming competent, they can be removed. So as long as the caliph is maintaining needs of the people and maintaining competency, the caliph doesn't need to focus every 4 years on trying to get re-elected, making fake promises, taking bribes for their campaign, and making token gestures before election time. The caliph can get onto the job of just dealing with the rational day-to-day needs of the people and how they are rationally dealt with and provided for. And this is really the fundamental difference between Islam and, I would say, secular liberalism. Because, in a way, the structure might seem similar, but the purpose of the state is different. And the motivations of those in government and the people are different. Secular liberalism looks at interest groups, and the interest group that gets in power, their interest group gets privileges. Those who didn't get the interest group in power don't get the privileges they want. Whereas in Islam, it doesn't look at partisan politics or interest groups, but rather whatever laws and interests are being applied, it is in the interests of Islam, on the general basis of the interests that all Muslims hold within the Sharia. And the pursuit of the interest of the Sharia is the concern. So the Sharia acts as this independent, impartial arbitrator that defines the Muslim people's interests and allows these interests to come about without Muslims thinking, oh, if a Sunni gets into power, I'm going to lose out. Or if a Shafi or a Hanafi gets into power, my school of thought will lose out. This thinking does not occur because it doesn't matter who's in power. They'll have to be obliged to fulfill the interest of Islamic law. So I would say in this case, Islam was able to eliminate, for the most part, at least compared to modern day nation state systems, sectarianism and prevent fascism. Fascism, the belief of that a certain ethnic group or a majority within a nation has a right to dictate the will of the nation and everyone must conform in a uniform manner, doesn't exist. And now there's a little question that might come up, and I'll elaborate more in the Q&A, but I'll wrap it up. And that is, well, what about non-Muslims? And that is the question that people are going to ask. What about non-Muslims? And here is where Islam really comes into its own, because non-Muslims are not viewed to be under the obligation of being under the Sharia, because non-Muslims don't believe in Sharia. It'd be unfair to stop Christians eating pork or drinking wine because they don't believe it's illegal in their interpretation, or at least most interpretations of Christianity. So what Islam does is it grants autonomy, a type of autonomy to non-Muslims to live under their own law systems. And we saw, for example, in the 19th and 20th century, the Ottoman Caliphate system, which was throughout the Middle East, before the Middle East was cut up into pieces by the British and refashioned into a feuding, warring states. We saw that Christians, we saw Jews, we saw Christians of different denominations and Muslims generally live side by side very peacefully, Christians being given autonomous zones, autonomous areas, they lived under their own culture. And when, even ironically, when Europe pressed the Ottoman Caliphate to abolish this system of plurality and establish a one law for all, many minorities, like the Armenians, for example, didn't want the abolition of this plurality and this one law for all citizenship, which is a modern Western concept, because it would mean that the Armenians would have to give up their autonomy and part of their culture and their privileges that they got in that autonomy and have to subscribe to Ottomanism, which they didn't want to do. So Islam creates a true multicultural, true pluralistic state. Whereas in a democracy, this one law for all concept sounds fair in appearance. But what it means is that it actually means there's uniformity. And what you see discussed in European states currently and in Western states and in America now is all this talk about minorities not assimilating into the culture. These are immigrants. They don't assimilate into our culture. We have to deal with them. They don't subscribe to British values, French values, Romanian values, whatever values. You see this rhetoric come up, and it's not the first time it's come up. If anyone that reads history knows that it came up with Jews during the last century, and before that in Protestant countries with Catholics as well. And now, obviously, Muslims are the ones on the new kids on the block who are being subjected to similar suspicions and similar questions as to whether they can integrate. Why does any country demand that people conform to a uniform culture, to a monoculture? And this is the problem that you get in democracy. Everyone's fighting for this one table where it's uniform for all, one law for all, and then it then becomes one culture for all, which is why many democracies are susceptible, I would argue, to fascism, whereas in Islam, a pluralistic system is not susceptible to fascism. So really, just to conclude, I would say that no such example of a system, unfortunately, exists today after the Ottoman Caliphate was dismantled after World War I. But I think it would be an amazing thing, an amazing example, for the Muslim world to re-establish and show to the rest of the world an alternative way of life which can guarantee peace and prosperity to what people think are the current false dichotomies that exist in the world today. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. So the floor is now open for questions.
Sorry, you said just there at the end of your speech that you have a truly multicultural pluralist system under Islam. But do you believe, as an introduction to my question, I need to ask you another question. Do you believe that apostasy is completely banned under Sharia, that a Muslim cannot leave Islam? Do you believe that a Muslim can leave Islam and join another religion?
Okay, well, I think that in Islam, no one obviously is compelled to be any particular belief system or not. And simply just changing one's mind isn't illegal in any understanding of Islam. What is confused is sedition and treason, which is generally confused with apostasy. The classical laws in Islam, which are the laws of irtidad, which has been unfortunately translated as apostasy, I'd argue are basically anti-sedition laws. And the reason is demonstrated by the fact that, for example, there's many examples at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where one Bedouin man came up to him and said, I want to take back my pledge of Islam. So he became Muslim, he made a pledge to Islam, and he wanted to renege that pledge. And the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, just turned his head away from the person. And the person insisted, no, like, take back my pledge, I want to renege it. The Prophet Muhammad turned his head, and the Prophet Muhammad turned his way three times, and the person just walked out away freely. The person wasn't hunted down and killed or executed, but rather was allowed to just walk away freely. The person just didn't want to be a Muslim anymore. We also see that many the cases at the time the Prophet Muhammad was involving people who were trying to commit sedition, trying to disrupt the society and undermine the basis of the state. Now, I want to make it absolutely clear that in an Islamic government, It's not considered to be sedition to criticize Islam. Many non-Muslims published books in Arabic in medieval times criticizing Islam. One, I know Ireland's ostensibly a Catholic country. So I'll give you an example. St. John of Damascus, a Catholic saint. Why was he called St. John of Damascus? Well, he lived in Islamic Syria. And he wrote one of the first Christian polemics against Islam. And he published it, well, he didn't leave Syria, or he didn't leave the Levant, he published it in the Levant, under Muslim government. And he wasn't persecuted for it, he wasn't killed, he wasn't hunted down. And what you saw happen to people who wrote criticisms of Islam, published books, was they were responded to by other scholars who would write counter-refutations in their own books, which is what happens in any academia today. So you can find atheist discourses, you can find public debates. And in Islam, it's not seditious for a person to say, I have doubts about Islam if you're a Muslim. I'm a Muslim and I have doubts about... That's not seditious. And there's also no iron curtain around the Islamic government that says, you can't leave this country if you don't like it. So these are all misconceptions. But I also want to also highlight that the system I'm calling for is not a utopia. Everyone thinks, oh, that sounds very utopic. Well no, because utopias can't exist because humans are not perfect. And the very fact that criminality exists shows that utopia is not perfect. And the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam guided Muslims by teaching Muslims that when applying Islamic laws to also apply alongside mercy and forgiveness. So for example, most people don't realize that poor people who steal because they're poor cannot be punished in Islam, are not punished in Islamic under Islamic law, poor people. Or people who basically have committed murder, but the family the victim's family choose to forgive that person, and instead that person has to pay monetary compensation, that can occur. There can be forgiveness. If the victim's family choose, or if they don't choose, then the person's punished with the same punishment. So Islam, to kind of in a nutshell, it's not what it's the Islamic government is not utopia, and of course there's many, you know, obviously histories we can cite there was things didn't go quite according to the Islamic rules, but by the by, I think it was the best system, because I thought never did you see as much peace between different Christian sects, Muslims and Jews in the Middle East than you saw under 1,400 years of Islamic government. Yeah, whereas just 100 years of secular government, well, just look at the Middle East today, and I think the question answers itself.
But sorry, I didn't catch that. So do you believe...
believe that it is, like, I presume you said no, that it is okay for a Muslim to leave Islam and to take up another religion, that it's okay for a Christian to spread Christianity in an Islamic country as is illegal in Saudi Arabia.
We're not, no one's defending Saudi Arabia here, by the way. This is that's a constitutional monarchy, which we should all look to British history for its creation. But to be clear, simply changing your mind is not punishable in Islam. And the second point you made, sorry, so that and oh yeah,
no, I believe
can Christians preach publicly? There's a long history of Christians preaching publicly in Muslim lands for centuries.
So do you have a follow-up question for that?
The only point I had to add to that is that if you were to believe that, then it's clearly not possible to have a multicultural system when you can't have people moving between cultural groups. But if you think it's okay for someone to move from Islam to it, it's fine. My only question that leads from that is that if the state relies on there being a majority Muslim population, if it relies on Muslims having the power of government, then how can it not, and spreading these other ideologies would move people away from following Islam, how is that not undermining the principles of the state? How is that not sedition and bringing an end to the state?
Well, I would say that Muslims would have confidence that Islam could stand up on its own intellectual merits, so it wouldn't consider to be a problem. In fact, it helps sharpen Muslim minds by subjecting Muslims who have a belief that they might have initially just was learned as a kid to critical discourse that might actually help them sharpen their understanding of Islam and why they're Muslim in the first place. So that it carries a utility to it of having different beliefs within an Islamic government. But as I said, sedition, irtidad, or sedition is punished in Islam, but not someone just saying in their head, I'm going to change, I don't believe in Islam anymore, and so on. That's not what is punished.
Thanks. Martin, I believe you had a couple of points you wanted to make.
Yeah, very nice talk. No? I had a couple of points that maybe will add a little bit more to the discussion. So even in the literature, when you're talking about authoritarian regimes and democratic regimes, that doesn't mean that, or totalitarian regimes, that doesn't mean that by definition that totalitarian or authoritarian regimes are bad regimes and that democracy is the good one. We have good examples of authoritarian regimes performing very well. So I might be even wanting to live in Singapore back in the 1990s. The economy was booming, very good universities, the standard of living was increasing. So it is considered to be, so we have examples of authoritarian rule that has been working well, even in terms of protection, in terms of protection of the citizens and all the benefits that they will have. So that kind of distinction, yeah, democracy, we should be looking, probably that's going back to the main point. When we are defining a concept of, political concept, a political system, we should be going back to the core of that political system. So democracy is nothing more than giving opportunity for elections. The authoritarian way would be that you have to overthrow the regime. Democracy, the regime, call it regime, might be good, maybe bad. There is possibility on every 4 years to have elections. Those elections, you might have a government like in Japan. There was a government coming from one political party for the 50 years. They have high level of democracy. there are elections, people are voting just for one political party, and one political party has been in power for 50 years. It changed recently, 2006, came back again in 2009. Since Second World War, they were in power in Japan. So in that kind of sense, we don't have to necessarily make those kind of negative or positive distinctions. The only difference when we have democracy, we should go to the core of it, is you have a chance for elections, not more than that. Once we start interpreting the concepts, then we get into this kind of issue. So the issue of, in democracy you have elections every 4 years, so politicians are going to be corrupt in order to win those elections. But we can say the same thing about the caliph, right? Because the caliph, just by having the long-term ruling or very difficult way to be impeached, might be, again, corrupt. So this is a personalistic view about that particular politician or that particular caliph. It has nothing to do with system. It's our way of how we are going to approach that system, rather than that it has something that is provoked by the system itself. The system itself, the difference is very, very minimal. It's you have elections or not. It's a rules of a game. Basically, it's not even a complicated game. It's quite a simple game. I agree with the media effect and influence. And then if you have a media effect and influence, of course, one group, one interest group can have much higher opinion compared to other groups. But we should not kill the system. We should build up the system because of that. We see that's a problem. Let's work from there to improve the system. We cannot just say, there are flaws in the system. There are huge flaws in democracy, huge flaws with accountability, huge flaws with elections, and etc. But that doesn't mean that we have to give up and now go back to a prehistorical view of the world. We need to build up the system. Democracy is not a perfect one. It needs to be built up in something different, something better, something that will include this kind of different characteristics and will provide us with better life in future. So, by definition, democracy does not mean that we'll solve all the problems in the society. Far from that. It is just one given value compared to what we had before. And again, that what we had before, authoritarian regimes, or that doesn't mean that it's bad by definition. In terms of defining the Aristotelian view of democracy, you see, the direct rule of democracy might be rootless. So that's why we have this kind of new interpretation of representative democracies, rather than we all going on a square. First, it's not possible. There's so many now. Second, look what's happening in Switzerland. It's not by definition good. Look what's happening in Ireland. You can have a referendum, but that referendum might be very, very restrictive toward some groups. That doesn't mean that if we have pure direct representation that will end up in a perfect society. Nobody knows what a perfect society will be. We are still searching. We are basically in a dark room poking around, trying to find our way how to get out. So we might be going in the wrong direction. Nobody's saying that this is a perfect system. But it seems a little bit better because it gives us a choice. That choice might be pure, might lead us in a very bad direction, like it's happening in sub-Saharan Africa. You have so many countries that just including this kind of elections is leading toward disasters, not toward prosperity. You have other countries where this concept has worked, but it's just that kind of one minimal point. So the only difference between the authoritarian system or the democratic system should be seen in the periodic elections. They might be good, they might be bad. We don't know. We're going to come up probably with something better. We should think. You should think about coming up with something better. That's something that will that can be implemented in the system, that can make your lives better, and that can make the lives of your children better. And my final point in this sense would be that what we are living together, our history, it's the most peaceful history ever. So our lives, we are going to live the longest compared to our grandparents, compared to our ancestors. We are living much more richer, we have much more food. The whole world, the whole global society, we are increasing in numbers. The world today is much better than the world was yesterday, and it was before. We should be critical about the world we are living today, because only if we are being critical, we are going to improve in future. If we just say that we are not critical anymore, then we are just going to stagnate. So we have to be critical, but we also have to acknowledge that the world we have today, in terms of peace and security, with all the worlds, with all the problems that are going around, it's much better than, 30 years BC, when our average age was going to be 25, 30 years. So probably half of the audience here was going to be already dead.
May I make just a brief talk? I mean, I agree that we shouldn't go back to, you said prehistoric, well, ancient systems. But the problem is that democracy literally is an ancient system, that it is actually from the ancient world, and we've, let's say, brought some parts or aspects to it to the fore. So people aren't averse to going back to history to bring examples in the past. So all I'm saying is that maybe we should consider a recent and more modern example, an Islamic government, as a comparison, or at least for Muslims here who obviously are trying to look for solutions for the Muslim world. I would say that republicanism or representative government isn't a new idea. Obviously, the Romans, they were one of the first republics, although republics existed even prior to them in different shapes and forms. So it's not a new system. Someone could even ask that the Roman system was so complex because it had different courts for the plebeians and the so-called you could call the middle class and the patricians, the upper class. They had so many different checks and balances. They probably had more checks and balances on government than modern governments do, actually. They really were really quite complex. So we're not even implementing as accountable government as the ancients even did today. But what I would say in terms of the idea that democracies give us a choice, but then not... They give us a choice, yes, it's a limited choice. You know, do you want oranges or apples? But maybe you want grapes, or maybe you want something else. And unfortunately, the choice doesn't seem so bad until one of the choices is bananas and nuts. One candidate's bananas, other candidate's nuts. What do you do in that situation? Or, well, the current plight of the American voter, I think. And this is the situation. That it's not really much choice because that you have, you can't really affect the government. Whereas what I would say is in an Islamic government, choice, I wouldn't say the case that obviously Muslims have a choice about what specific policies a caliph might implement, like what's the highway code going to be like and what's going to be the tariffs on exported goods and so on. So of course, governments decide these matters, but at least when a Muslim makes a choice to elect or select a caliph, it's done in the knowledge that the caliph is obliged to fulfill the conditions of government, which is the interests of Islamic law. The current candidates, whoever you vote for in a democracy, has no obligation to you to fulfill any of their election promises to you. You can't take them to court for that. You say, oh, they lied, they told us that they'd do this. You say, yeah, well... interests change, situation changes. You don't have to follow any of the promises. So you don't really have any choice if there's no beholden obligation upon the candidate you select in a secular democracy. Now, and again, no one here is talking about perfect societies or utopias because they can't exist. Humans are imperfect and there'll never be a perfect society. I suppose what we're talking about is the best society possible with what we have to work with, which is obviously human beings. And if you remove partisan politics from politics itself, then surely wouldn't that be a better outcome for that? And of course, the similarity between secular liberalism, secular liberal democracy, and an Islamic government is that really in both systems, in theory anyway, secular liberalism is meant to implement its ideology irrespective of what you choose. You can't select theory radical communism. You can't. The American Constitution would not allow you to do that, whatever candidate you select. Likewise in the UK, likewise in all the governments. You can't select a completely different ideology from the state ideology. That doesn't change. And so in a way, the government just or the system only wants you to consent to the system every 4 years or 5 years. That's why the politicians are very eager for you to always vote, because that's really just you consenting to the system. In an Islamic government... It's a bit more honest about it. It doesn't say you have a choice, but really we just want consent. In Islamic government, it's about consent, but the consent is to implementing a set of interests which come hell or high water will always remain the same and will never change. There will never be any new interest to say, oh, I don't like this minority. Let's force assimilate them or evict them or persecute them. That will come to pass because in Islam, minorities are guaranteed that they are protected. And so the Prophet Muhammad said that anyone who harmed a non-Muslim who's living under covenant, in Islamic government, is anyone who's harmed a dhimmi, which is the Arabic term, has harmed him. So anyone who harms a non-Muslim who lives under Islamic government or oppresses him in one other narration by the Prophet Muhammad, oppresses or takes away from that person something without their consent, the Prophet Muhammad said to Muslims that he himself will oppose that Muslim and condemn him basically on the Day of Judgment. So the Muslims are scared to oppress non-Muslims or to harm them or even in one narration humiliate them. You're not even allowed to, because the Prophet Muhammad forbade it with a very, very scary prohibition that puts literally the fear of God into Muslims. You understand? Can Western democracies say the same and give the same concerning protection to their minorities when they're busy talking about these minorities? Yes, we will tolerate them, but what if they are a danger? What do we do then? Oh, we have to enact certain policies to protect our national values. That you see that discourse coming up again and again, and that is the problem with current Western democracies and with democracies in general. Where look at Iraq, you had a country. Okay, Saddam Hussein, nasty guy. I wasn't shedding any tears when he was deposed. But look what happened after him. The state split into three different parts, and they started fighting each other, and it was really brutal and nasty, and saw the rise of crazy, brutal killers. So I would say that let's not be stuck to thinking, well, maybe if I can just repair this broken system, it could be better, or I can improve it. If it's fundamentally flawed in its basis, then we have to think, well, maybe we should try something that has a completely different basis that might provide an alternative solution to the continuing repetitive merry-go-round that we've been experiencing for literally decades, if not centuries.
John. I think the only issue I have with using religion, and I say religion because the topic of this debate could be Christianity or democracy or Hinduism, is that there is no consensus there. Because when you base your laws on a holy text, you're open to interpretations. So I could take an extreme one. So I could say that an adulterer needs to be stoned. Now that's one interpretation that someone's taken from a passage. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand this passage to be that there was a woman who had confessed to Muhammad that she was an adulterer. And on three occasions, she asked Muhammad, could she be punished for it? And he turned away on each time. And until she begged that she was so sorrowful, then he granted her wish for stoning. So he wasn't, as an atheist, interpreting that passage. It wasn't that Muhammad was an advocate of stoning adulterers. But you see, I could easily have the same debate with another Islamic scholar, and he could say, well, no, you should stone adulterers, and that was how Muhammad dealt with such a case. And I think when you have two political or cultural ideologies debating with each other, and it comes from a place where the only person who's accountable is God, who we can get no answer from, I think when it comes to rule of law, it should be very secular and it should be very straightforward and set in stone, that there is no blurred lines, there's no misinterpretation. Genocide is wrong. You can't look at the Human Rights Charter and interpret it in a different way. It's plain black and white. So that's where I have a problem, where religion for me is strictly private and it's something for your own weapon and your own spirituality. But when it comes to formulating laws and opinions on something that, as an atheist, I can't say that you have facts to back it up, that your word is greater than the Geneva Conventions, for example, if you can understand my question. I think that's the problem with any religion, that you're going to have the basis of law. It's the consensus. And how can we decide when it's, as I said, you know, the guy who's accountable is God upstairs.
Okay, I'll deal with that in, let's say, reverse order. So you're saying that basically, how can we base a government or a system on something that can't be proven when we should maybe just follow the things like Geneva Convention and other such institutions? But here's the thing. It's not a debate whether we can prove it or not. That's not a discussion. However, in practice, it's really all the same. Geneva Convention is what is it? It's words written on a piece of paper. It's interpreted by lawyers. American Constitution, words on paper, interpreted by lawyers and judges. The Quran and the narration of the Prophet Muhammad are, well, they're also memorized, but they're also words written on paper, interpreted by judges. So we're all dealing with words, books, and judges and interpretation. That doesn't change, and there's no escape from that, unless you're an anarchist. But the case is, what words are we going to base our system on? Are we going to base our system on an idea that, well, this piece of paper was written by humans, it's no longer convenient for us to implement this, so what was made by humans can be taken away by humans. Humans giveth and humans taketh away, right? In East Europe, I think it was in the Balkans, the split, the destruction of obviously Yugoslavia. The Serbs, not the Serbs, but rather a faction of the Serbs, obviously Slobodan Milosevic and many others, thought it was in the national interest of Serbia, for the protection of Serbs, to forcefully evict, by any means, fair or foul, non-Serbs. And they did that because they said it was in the national interest. It's in the national interest. You see, that's the thing. The God of national interest is a very fickle and capricious God. And that God has justified many genocides throughout Western and global history. Whereas the God that I believe in doesn't change his mind, isn't capricious, and has instituted laws which I don't believe change and are set in stone, so to speak. So when Prophet Muhammad tells me as a Muslim that Christians, Jews, and others are to be respected and are not to be oppressed, they're to be tolerated even if they are inconvenient to you, then I have to accept that as a gospel, so to speak, right? And as for the issue of, well, we can't account God, first of all, I say it's actually God that accounts us, but we're not here to account God, but we can account caliphs, and we can account judges, who if they make a mistake, because they are fallible human beings, not infallible, we don't believe they're infallible. They can be accounted, they can be removed from power. In fact, if you look at some early Islamic history, there was a lot of uprisings and revolutions. Some people try to cite that as an example that Islamic government might not be stable. They say, well, actually, no, because when these caliphs became corrupt, there was an immune system response. The Muslims rose up and basically tried to depose these corrupt leaders. And that, in effect, the Islamic immune system getting to work and removing corrupt dictators and tyrants. As for your other point, as for interpretation, thankfully, compared to other systems, either religion or ideologies, Islam has far more agreement about what a government looks like and Islamic laws, the basic Islamic laws, than any other system, maybe except Judaism, possibly. Because what you'll find is, if you take, let's say, the three of the biggest, people say, the biggest sects of Islam, quote-unquote, which is Sunni and Shia, and there's one that you might not have heard of called the Ibadis, which are descendants of the Khawarij, a long story. Anyway, three main sects. They don't disagree that there should be a caliph, and they don't generally disagree on the structure of it or what the caliph does. But they disagree on, the Ibadis might disagree on some policies of the, well, they disagree on some of the early companions of the Prophet Muhammad, what they did as caliphs, and the Shias disagree on who can be a caliph, but they don't disagree on the system itself. But generally, all schools of thought accept that you can be under a caliph of a different school of thought. And because the Prophet Muhammad taught Muslims that a judge that makes an interpretation of Islam, gets it wrong, still gets rewarded by God. But a judge who makes an interpretation of Islam, gets it right, gets double reward. You understand? So we're motivated to seek the right interpretation, but we don't condemn each other for the wrong interpretation of Islam. You see, we never had let's say, a Catholic church which dictated theology. And theology, the caliphs don't even touch theology. Right? The discussions on points of this has got nothing to do with the caliph. Caliph talks with the political jurisdiction, deals with the political jurisdiction of government. And I think lastly, the point on adulterers. The Prophet Muhammad taught, similar to the Judaic laws, on the punishment for adulterers. That is what the Prophet Muhammad taught, which you obviously highlighted. However, what people don't focus on is that the law is, in essence, primarily symbolic and more of a deterrent, because the requisite amount of evidence required to actually prosecute anyone for adultery is, if you were looking at a practical law system, would be just impossible, virtually impossible to implement. You need four witnesses. Witnesses have to actually see penetration, not just two naked people next to each other making noises. That doesn't even count as evidence. Right? So it's literally impossible unless two people did it in front of a stadium and filmed themselves in the most explicit manner. It's literally impossible. And I mentioned what I said before, the caliph does not have a jurisdiction to what people do in the privacy of their own homes. And that's very important. So a Muslim is prohibited from drinking alcohol in Islam, yes. It's a sin. Publicly, it's also punishable if you go out in public and drink alcohol. Apparently, I heard in Belfast, it's also illegal to drink alcohol in public as well. Maybe Sharia law? No. however, if a Muslim drinks alcohol in the privacy of their own home, the political jurisdictional state doesn't extend there. It can't punish that person for doing so. Understand? So really, these laws are really meant to kind of be an encouragement to someone who wants to be religious, to be religious. But if they don't want, if they don't want to, there's a private space they can retreat.
The issue is when they don't see it as the symbolic. If they take it literally, that's when we get dangerous, and that's dangerous for all religions.
Literalism has never been a problem. If we go to a court, right, or let's say someone's trying to attack you, someone's trying to kill you, you call the police, and the police come and say, "What's the matter?" So this person's trying to kill me. And the police says, so? Say, well, you're going to protect me. So why? Well, the law says that it's illegal for people to kill each other. Why are you taking it literally? Right? Would the policeman say to you, well, the problem is we are taking our law literally, so we're not going to defend you. No, you hope the police takes the law literally because they're going to use that law to defend you. Right? Literalism isn't the problem. Right? The problem is whether people actually implement due to their conscience or due to whatever selfish desires they might have. And I'm arguing that we need a state of conscience, not a state of party interest or faction or business interest, where it's not conscience or principle that decides, but just who has more money or who speaks the loudest or who has deceived the people enough.
Okay. Another question. So quick question and quick reply. So, yeah.
Two questions. One, under the kind of state you would advocate, would there be a prohibition on blasphemy? And the second question, would non-Muslims have to pay a tax that Muslims don't have to pay?
Okay. I'm not going to say on the state I envision, because it's not, I didn't invent this. I'm just iterating to you, I suppose, historical precedent, Islamic scripture, stuff that is agreed between all schools of thought, all eight schools of thought in Islam, at least eight of the modern ones anyway, that have remained today. So, should we have a blasphemy law? Does Ireland still have a blasphemy law? Did you repeal it? It still does. Okay, well, don't worry. In Islamic government, it's more judged on the intention. So there's discussions between classical Islamic scholars, you can find, I think they even translate into English in many books, where they discuss non-Muslims who might be making points about Islam. Is it an insult? Is it should be taken as a blasphemy? How do we understand that? And it was generally accepted, the majority opinion of these scholars were, that because a person isn't believing in Islam, so let's say they're an atheist and they don't believe in God. Well, technically you could say, I don't believe in God, might be considered to be blasphemy, right? But they're an atheist and you've recognized them as an atheist, you've tolerated them as an atheist, so then how could you prosecute them for merely stating their own opinions, right? So in Islam, there is no prohibition of people criticizing Islam and saying things which would be maybe perceived as blasphemous, if that's their opinion. What is regulated, however, is gratuitous insult. That's a difference, where the person literally intends to insult, not causes offence. Because I know people say offence is in the eye of the beholder, right? Well, strange enough, in the UK law, they restrict much speech considering whether it constitutes offence, strangely. They use the word offence. But Islam doesn't look at offence. Islam looks at the intent. So, you know, the mens rea. Does a person have an intent to insult? And if that's the case, then there is some regulation there, because people shouldn't insult each other's beliefs that they hold sacred. How does that benefit free speech? The point of free speech is to find truth. How is insult meant to help anyone pursue truth? Doesn't. Criticism does, yes. Airing your opinions does, yeah, but that's fine. As to your other point, so there is no prohibition on people criticizing Islam in an Islamic government. Your other point was, do non-Muslims pay tax? Well, here's the thing. Well, we all pay tax. But well, I mean, extra tax. Muslims are under a religious obligation to pay an alms tax, which is, or what's called a wealth tax, called zakat. It's really a wealth redistribution tax from the rich to the poor, basically. But anyone who reaches the amount of money, which I think is 200 dinars or gold coins, has to pay 2.5% of that. Goes to 8 categories of people: poor, people in debt, slaves to get them out of slavery, and a whole number of cases, of areas. Whereas non-Muslims don't pay zakat, because zakat is a religious obligation on Muslims, not on non-Muslims. However, Muslims are obliged, or Muslim males are obliged, to be reservists in the army and defend the borders if necessary. However, non-Muslim males are not expected to join Muslim armies as reservists and defend the state that they might not necessarily believe in the basis for. Right? That's a bit unfair. So, as a military waiver, instead of being a reservist, non-Muslim males pay what you might call a Rousseauian citizenship tax. Because what is the basic contract between you and the state as a citizen? You pay the state money, state provides you protection in return. So the state, non-Muslims pay that to the state then provides protection for the borders and facilitates the army, of which Muslims have to be part of the army. However, if non-Muslim males want to be equal with their Muslim male comrades, then if they join as reservists in the army, they don't have to pay they don't have to pay that tax, that military waiver tax, right? So if non-Muslim males want to be alongside Muslim males doing the job of being military reservists, then there's no tax on anyone. But if they don't want to be a military reservist, then they have to pay a military waiver tax. So in a way, it's actually, there's equality there. The only difference is that Muslims don't have the privilege of waiving military service. So in a way, non-Muslims are actually privileged. I say males because women and children, Muslim or non-Muslim, are exempt from both military service and paying any military waiver tax, because they're not expected to join the army.
Okay, I've been informed that we are almost out of time, so I'm going to use my position here, exploit my position as the moderator here, and ask both the speakers for one of my own question, and which is that if current events are to account for anything or show for anything, we all realize that both the enlightened version of secular liberal democracy, however we define it, and the enlightened version of Islam, as you so eloquently kind of explained today, they all need to, both these groups, they need to do more to sort of raise awareness about the key tenets and the key messages. So as experts in this subject, what would your one recommendation be for these both these groups to kind of spread this enlightened message to the larger masses in the interest of global peace? So I'll start with you, Han.
Thanks. So that brings us back to the main question, which offers better solution for global peace, which I don't think that we answered. But my intuition will tell me that both are will bring solution to a global peace, as long as we don't interpret them subjectively. So as long as we keep ourselves outside of interpretation, because you see, policy is not a product of the political system. So policy is not democracy. Policy is product of politicians. Therefore, if Blair or Bush or somebody has done something wrong, you blame them. You don't blame the democratic system or the political system, because that's just a system, has nothing to do with any kind of solution. So my final thought would be both are correct for global peace, because neither democracy as a political system nor Islam as a religion has something to do against having a global peace or unity in the world.
My final thought would be, firstly, to thank my interlocutor for his erudite and very academic discourse into democracy. I read a lot of his stuff before coming to this debate, and I was very impressed with it and so on. So something to learn for all of us. What I would say is that Islam is a little different from maybe religions like Christianity, because it didn't emerge from, let's say, historical peculiarities that meant that Christianity didn't have a law system to itself, or there's debates as to whether it should have a law system. Does the Old Testament still count? Does it not still count? Judaism does have a law system, but Islam does have a law system. And so unlike Christianity, which after many years there was debate as to when secularism arose out of some of the problems of Christianity in trying to deal with law and how government should work. So I don't blame the Western civilization too much, because they did the best of what they had with them. But that being said, we have to look at what can create global peace and what can create global stability. And I would say that it wouldn't be so much of a problem if secular liberalism works really great in the West, but not everywhere else. And then I would just say, well, you know, Eric X. Lee, this Chinese political scientist, he made a great discussion in TEDx and Oxford University. He said that secular liberalism is a great system, but for the West, although civilizations like China, others have their own system that should come up from indigenously, from their own institutions and their own culture, which might be very different, and you just have to respect that. I would say that, but I'm just concerned that secular liberalism is not maintaining stability in the West, and we're seeing the rise of far-right groups, fascism, we're seeing the rise of ultranationalism and intolerance to immigrants again. And I think this is something that we have to really ask ourselves, do some soul searching, and think, is this something that is just a temporary thing? Or if we open the history books, do we see this as a constantly recurring pattern? So that's really what I would like to raise. And I would like to raise that secular liberalism wouldn't be so problematic in that sense if it was still based on the original concept of natural rights, which believed that somehow all these human rights we have are intended by God, and you can see it in nature, this is intended by God. Instead, it was replaced by utilitarianism, for a very secular basis, which said that what is right is really what produces the greatest good for the greatest amount of people. However, what that really translates to is that your rights, your human rights, are only protected as long as it's convenient to national interest. So my kind of final question to you, which I'm going to kind of put to the audience, maybe to ask yourselves, is what do you think is... which system would you prefer, or do you think you'd feel more comfortable under? A system whereby it believes that your rights are protected by guarantees from God, which cannot be changed, or a system that says we guarantee your rights only so far as it is convenient at any point in time to the national interest? I'll leave that question to you. Thanks for listening to us.
So I guess what we got from that is that we should continue to have more debates like this, and that is the only way to spread the message. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree.